The motorcycle escort, sirens wailing, was forced to moderate its speed by the condition of the road through the new area of squatters' slums that had grown up around the capital. The tarmac was pitted with sharp-edged craters, while chickens and pigs scattered, cackling and grunting, ahead of the outriders. The presidential car, another recent gift from the same Middle Eastern oil potentate, was a black Mercedes. It was a mark of his high regard that President Tafari had sent it down to Lake House on the waterfront to fetch his guest to the audience. Ning Cheng Gong sat behind the chauffeur and studied these first glimpses of Ubomo with interest. After what he had observed in Asia and other parts of Africa in which he had served, the poverty and degradation of the slums through which they drove neither repelled nor shocked him. From his father he had learned to look upon swarming humanity as either a source of cheap labour or a market for the goods and services he had to sell. "Where are human beings, there are no profit," his father had pointed out on numerous occasions. "The more people, the better. Always, when human lives are cheap, there are great fortunes to be made. We, the lucky dragon, must resist any effort to limit population growth in the third world. People are a basic stock in trade." Cheng smiled at his father's wisdom, derived from a study of history. His father's view was that only when human populations had been checked and limited by extraneous factors had the common man regained dignity and a measure of control over his own destiny. The terrible depredations of the great plagues of medieval times had broken the slavery of the feudal system of Europe. They had reduced human populations to the point where men had scarcity value and could bargain for their labour once again. The great wars of this century had smashed the class system of inherited privilege and fortune and ushered in this aberrant age of human rights, in which the common men of inferior races were taught that they were the equal of their betters. In Cheng's view and that of his father, common men had no such divine rights, any more than the antelope in the wild deserved special protection from the lion. When the mass of humanity reached such proportions that human life was cheap, that was the age of opportunity for the great predators to emerge, predators like Lucky Dragon. In Africa, that time was fast approaching, as populations swarmed like hiving bees. He thought about the little Cambodian boat girl, whose corpse now lay in the dark depths of the China Sea. There were millions and tens of millions more like her in India and China and Africa and South America, for men like him. Cheng had recognized in the burgeoning populations of Africa a unique opportunity. That was the main reason that Lucky Dragon was drawn so irresistibly to this continent. That was why he was going now to a meeting with the president of this country, which would soon be made to render up its wealth to him. He would suck the juice from it, throw away the empty skin, and pluck another from the tree. He smiled at the metaphor and raised his eyes to the green hill above the town on which Government House stood. President Ephraim Tafari had an honour guard in maroon uniforms and white sun helmets drawn up to welcome him, and a red carpet laid across the green lawn. He came down the carpet to meet Ning Cheng Gong personally and to shake his hand. He led him up onto the wide veranda and seated him in one of the carved armchairs under the revolving fan that hung from the ceiling. A Yuhali servant in ankle-length white robes, scarlet sash and tasselled fez offered him a silver tray of frosted glasses. Cheng refused the champagne and chose a glass of freshly squeezed orange juice. Ephraim Tafari took the armchair opposite him and crossed one long leg clad in crisp white cotton trousers over the other. He smiled at Cheng with all his charm. "I wanted our first meeting to be informal and relaxed," he explained, and made a deprecatory gesture towards his own open-neck sports shirt and sandals. "So you will excuse my casual attire, and the fact that I have none of my ministers with me." "Of course, Your Excellency," Cheng sipped the orange juice. "I am also delighted by this opportunity to get to know you and to be able to speak freely without the inhibition of having other people present."
"Sir Peter Harrison speaks very highly of you, Mr. Ning. He is a man whose opinion I value. I am sure that our relationship will be mutually rewarding."
For another 10 minutes they traded compliments and protestations of friendship and goodwill. Both of them were at ease with this flowery circumlocution. It was part of their separate cultures, and they understood instinctively the moves and counter-moves as they circled and closed in on the real business of their meeting. Finally, Cheng took a sealed envelope from the inside pocket of his white silk tropical suit. It was a piece of expensive stationery, glossy and cream-coloured, with a dragon motif embossed on the back flap. "My father and I want you to believe, Mr. President, that our commitment to your country is unswerving. We would like you to accept this as an earnest token of our friendship and concern." Cheng made his offering seem like a free and unsolicited gift, whereas both of them were aware that it had been the subject of intense and protracted bargaining. There had been other bidders in the market, not least of them the Arab oil sheik, who had provided the gunboat and the presidential Mercedes. It had taken all Sir Peter Harrison's influence to secure the deal for the Boss and Lucky Dragon Syndicate. The envelope contained the second instalment due to Ephraim Tafari in his personal capacity. The first instalment had been paid over 10 months previously on signature of the original agreement. President Tafari picked up the envelope and turned it over to examine the seal. His fingers were long and elegantly shaped and very dark against the stiff, creamy paper. He split the corner of the envelope with his thumbnail and unfolded the two documents it contained. One was a deposit receipt to a numbered bank account in Switzerland. The amount of the deposit was $10 million. The other was a share transfer document notarized in Luxembourg. A total of 30% of the syndicate's share equity was now registered in the name of Ephraim Tafari. The syndicate's formally registered name was the Ubomo Development Corporation. The president returned the documents to the open envelope and slipped it into the pocket of his flowered sports shirt. "Progress has not been as rapid as I had hoped," he said, his tone still courteous but underlaid with steel. "I hope that will change with your arrival, Mr. Ning." "I am aware of the delays. As you know, my field manager has been in Kahali for the last week or so. He has given me a full report of the situation. I believe that some of the blame must attach to a previous management put in place by Boss. There has been some reluctance to exploit all available assets." Cheng made a delicately pejorative gesture. "Mr. Purvis of Boss, who is now safely on his way back to London, was a sensitive man. You know how squeamish these Englishmen can be. My field manager informs me that we are short of labour." "I assure you, Mr. Ning, that you will have all the labour you require." Tafari's smile became strained at the thinly veiled complaint. 30,000, Cheng said softly. "That was the original estimate approved by you, Your Excellency. So far we have been given fewer than 10,000. "You will have the rest before the beginning of next month." Tafari was no longer smiling. "I have given orders to the army. All political detainees and dissidents are to be rounded up and sent to the labour camps in the forest." "These will be members of the Uhali tribe?" Cheng asked. "Of course," Tafari snapped. "You didn't think for a moment that I would send you Haiter, did you?" Cheng smiled at the absurdity of that notion. "My field manager tells me that the Uhali are good workers, hardy and intelligent and compliant. We'll need most of them in the forest to begin with. It seems that we are experiencing problems there caused by the terrain and the climate. The roads are bad and machinery is bogging down. We'll be forced to use more men." "Yes, I warned the Boss people of that," Tafari agreed. "They were reluctant to use what they considered to be..." He hesitated. "That man Purvis referred to our convict labour as slave labour." He looked mildly amused by such pedantic definitions. "These Westerners," Cheng sympathised. "The English are bad enough, but the Americans are even worse. They do not understand Africa or the Orient. Their minds stop at Suez." He broke off. "I assure you, Mr. President, that an Easterner is now in control of the syndicate's operation. You will find that I do not suffer from these Western scruples." "It is a relief to be able to work with somebody who understands the necessities of life," Tafari agreed. "Which brings me to a hotel and casino project at Fish Eagle Bay. I understand from my field manager that nothing has been done there apart from the original survey of the area. He tells me that there is still a fishing village on a hotel site." "Not any longer,"
Tafari smiled. The area was cleared 2 days ago, soon after Purvis left for London. The village was a hotbed of counter-revolutionary activity. My soldiers rounded up all the dissidents. 200 able-bodied prisoners are already on their way to the concession area in the forest to join your labor force. The hotel site is ready for construction to begin. Your Excellency, I can see that you and I are going to work well together. May I show you the modifications that I have made to a schedule of works drawn up by Purvis?
He opened his briefcase and unfolded a large computer spreadsheet that covered the entire table between them. Tafari leaned forward and listened with interest as Cheng pointed out the way in which he had restructured almost the entire syndicate operation. At the end of the lecture, Tafari's admiration was unconcealed.
"You have accomplished all this in the short time since you arrived in Yubomo?" he asked.
But Cheng shook his head.
"Not all of it, Your Excellency. Some of the replanning were done before I left Taipei. I had the benefits of my father's advice and the assistance of his headquarters staff at Lucky Dragon. Only part of her planning was necessitated after my arrival in Kahale, on the advice of my field manager and his report on the conditions and problems we have encountered in the forest."
"Remarkable," Tafari shook his head. "Sir Peter Harrison's opinion of you seems to be well-founded."
"Planning is one thing," Cheng pointed out modestly. "Execution is another thing entirely."
"I am sure that you will bring the same energy and drive to that part of the operation." Tafari looked at his wristwatch. "I am expecting a guest for lunch."
I'm sorry, Your Excellency. I have overstayed my welcome," Cheng made as if to rise.
"Not at all, Mr. Ning. I absolutely insist that you join us for lunch. It may amuse you to meet my other guest, a member of the film team which Sir Peter Harrison has hired."
"Ah, yes," Cheng looked dubious. "Sir Peter explained to my father and myself why he had invited a film company to Yubomo. I am not certain that I agree with him, however. The English have a saying about sleeping dogs. In my view, it may be better not to draw world attention to our operations. I would like to cancel the project and send the film team out of Yubomo."
"I am afraid it is too late for that," Tafari shook his head. "We have already received a great deal of adverse publicity. There is a woman, a protege of the previous president, Omeru." For another 10 minutes, they discussed Sir Peter's plan to defuse Kelly Kinnear's propaganda campaign by a counter-campaign of their own. "In any event," Tafari pointed out, "we can always suppress anything we don't like about this film production. Sir Peter Harrison has an approval clause written into the contract. We can even suppress the final product completely and destroy all copies of the film, if we feel that that is advisable."
"Of course, you are taking precautions to make certain that these people do not get to see any of our sensitive areas, the convict labor camps, the main logging operations, and the refill mining?"
"Trust me, Mr. Ning. They will see the pilot scheme only. I have a reliable military officer accompanying them at all times." He broke off at the sound of an approaching vehicle.
"Ah, that would be the person we are discussing, the cameraman and Captain Keijo."
"Cameraman?" Cheng asked as they watched Bonnie Mahoon and Captain Keijo cross the lawn towards them. "Inaccurate, I agree," Tafari chuckled. "But is there such a term as camera woman, I wonder?" He stood up and went to meet his guest. Captain Keijo came to attention and saluted. Tafari ignored him. Keijo's job was done. He delivered Bonnie. He turned on his heel and returned to wait in the army Land Rover. He knew it might be a long wait. Cheng studied the woman as Tafari led her down the veranda. She was too big and bosomy. She had no delicacy of bone structure nor refinement of feature. Both her nose and mouth were too large for his taste. Her freckled skin and coppery hair repelled him. Her voice and laughter, as she joked with Tafari, were loud and vulgar. Her confident attitude and powerful limbs made Cheng feel threatened, as though she were challenging his masculinity. He did not like a woman to be as strong and assertive as a man. He compared her unfavorably with the dainty, ivory-skinned women of his own race, with their straight black hair and submissive, self-effacing manner. However, he rose politely and smiled and shook her hand and saw that Tafari was quite smitten with the woman. He knew that Tafari had a dozen Hyter wives who were amongst the most beautiful of the tribe, but he supposed that the president was attracted by the novelty of this gross creature. Perhaps he felt that it would add to his status to have a white woman as a plaything. However, Cheng guessed shrewdly that he would tire of her soon enough and discard her as casually as he had taken her up. "Mr. Ning is the chief executive officer of the Ubomo Development Corporation," Tafari told Bonnie. "Technically, he is your boss." Bonnie chuckled. "Well, I can report that we're doing a hell of a job, boss." "I am delighted to hear that, Miss Mahoon," Cheng was unsmiling. "It is an important task you are undertaking. What have you accomplished so far?" "We have been working here in Kahali and on the lake. We've already filmed the site of the new hotel and casino." Both Cheng and Tafari listened seriously to her report. "Where are you moving after to do this?" Cheng wanted to know. "After we finish here, we're driving up country to the forest area, a place called Sengi Sengi. Have I got that right, Your Excellency?" she looked at Tafari.
"Quite right, my dear Miss Mahoon," Tafari assured her. "Sengi Sengi is the corporation's pilot scheme for utilizing the forest assets."
Cheng nodded. "I will be visiting the project myself at the very first opportunity." "Why don't you come up to Sengi Sengi while we're filming?" Bonnie suggested. "It would give much more weight to the production to have you in it, Mr. Ning." She paused as another thought struck her, and then with a boyish grin she turned to Ephraim Tafari. "But it would really be terrific to have you in the production, Mr. President. We could interview you on the site of the project at Sengi Sengi. You could explain to us your hopes and dreams for your country. Just think of that, Your Excellency." Ephraim Tafari smiled and shook his head. "I am a busy man. I don't think I could spare the time." But she could see he was tempted. He was enough of a politician to relish the prospect of favourable exposure to a wide audience. "It would be very valuable," she urged him, "for both Ubomo and your personal image. People out there in the big world have heard about you only vaguely. If they could see you, it would change their whole perception. I assure you, from a professional point of view, that you would look plain bloody marvellous on the screen. You are tall and handsome, and your voice is sensational. I swear I'd make you look like a film star." He liked the idea. He liked the flattery.
"Well, perhaps."
They both realized that he wanted to be persuaded just a little longer. "You could fly up to Sengi Sengi by helicopter," Bonnie pointed out. "It would take half a day, no more." She paused and pouted suggestively and touched his arm. "Unless, of course, you decided to stay over for a day or two. That would be okay by me also." Daniel and Bonnie, accompanied as always by Captain Cadro, drove up from Kahali. Although it was only a little over 200 miles, it took them 2 full days, for much of that time was spent not in travelling, but in filming the changing countryside and the rural tribes in their traditional manyatas that they found along the way. Captain Cadro was able to smooth the way and negotiate with the tribal elders. For a few Ubomo shillings, he arranged that they had the run of any of the Hyter villages that they passed. They filmed the young girls at the waterholes, clad only in tiny beaded skirts as they bathed and plaited each other's hair. The unmarried girls dressed their coiffures with a mixture of cow dung and red clay, until it was an intricate sculpture on top of their heads, adding inches to their already impressive height. They filmed the married women as they returned to the village in the long files, clad in flowing red matronly togas, swaying gracefully under brimming calabashes of water drawn from the spring. They filmed the herds of dappled, multicoloured cattle, with their wide horns and humped backs, against a background of flat-topped acacia and golden savanna grasslands. They filmed the herd boys bleeding a great black bull, twisting a leather thong around its neck to raise the congested vein beneath the skin, then piercing it with the point of an arrow and capturing the scarlet stream of blood in a bottle-shaped calabash. When the gourd was half filled, they sealed the wound in the bull's neck with a handful of clay and topped up the calabash with milk stripped directly from the udder. Then they added a dash of cow's urine to curdle the mixture into thick, cheesy curds.
"Low cholesterol," Daniel pointed out when Bonnie gagged theatrically. "And look at those Hyter figures."
"I'm looking," Bonnie assured him.
"Oh, alleluia, I'm looking."
The men wore only a red blanket over one shoulder, held with a belt at the waist. They allowed the skirts to flap open casually in the breeze, especially when Bonnie was nearby. They let her film as much as she wished of everything they possessed, staring into the lens with masculine arrogance, the elongated loops of their earlobes stopped with bone and ivory earrings. On the main road, their Land Rover passed ore trucks and logging trailers coming in the opposite direction. The weight of these massive vehicles, even though spread over a dozen axles and banks of massive tyres, rutted the road deeply and raised a fog of dust that covered the trees for a mile on both sides of the roadway with a thick coating of dark red talcum. Bonnie gloried in the effect of the sunlight through the dust cloud and the shapes of the trucks lumbering out of it like prehistoric monsters.